Welcome to our first The Week in 60 Minutes for 2021 from Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, January the 7th. We hope that you were able to have a restful Christmas despite the circumstances. Now, we had planned to start with the latest on the vaccine rollout, but we'll turn first to last night's extraordinary mob violence on Capitol Hill as Congress was acknowledging Joe Biden as victor in the presidential election of 2020. I'll be speaking to the Spectator's American team about what it means for Donald Trump, the new administration, and the state of America. Back in dear old Blighty, the latest wave of coronavirus has surprised everybody in its ferocity. One in 50 Brits now have the virus, one in 30 Londoners, with some hospitals running out of capacity. Unlike previous lockdowns, however, we now have a vaccine, indeed several, and the race is now on to vaccinate the 13 million most vulnerable before February is out. The Spectator team will bring you the latest COVID breakdown and political analysis. We'll also be joined by Jeremy Hunt, the former Conservative Health Secretary. Remember, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free, you'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. And a very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of The Week in 60 Minutes this year. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange, and we're delighted to be partners. First, America. It looked like the storming of the palace by the mob in some banana republic. In fact, it was happening in the heart of American democracy. The scenes were shocking, but perhaps not surprising. President Trump had been egging on his hardcore supporters for weeks with nonsense about a fraudulent, stolen election and the need to take a stand. What is surprising, given how well last night's protests were signposted, was how totally unprepared law enforcement was to deal with the assault on Capitol Hill. Their inability to defend the citadel of American democracy went round the world, warming the cockles of every authoritarian heart that despises the democratic process. The mob managed to occupy the Senate chamber and the offices of senior lawmakers. Joe Biden called it sedition, and it's hard not to agree with him. Donald Trump was lukewarm in urging his rioters to resist, and it's hard not to see him as the author of what happened last night. It is just some of what went down, brilliantly documented by ITV's Robert Moore.
USA! For 4 years, we have witnessed turmoil in America, but nothing quite like this. The pro-Trump crowd fought with the police, trying to break through their lines, intoxicated by the unlikely prospect of reversing America's election outcome. We watched as the standoff continued for at least an hour. Tear gas canisters were fired from the very stage on which Joe Biden will be inaugurated. But for Capitol Hill police officers, this was a losing battle.
This is exactly what was feared, but in no way is this a surprise. It has been fueled by the president's rhetoric, and it's increasingly clear this election has not healed the wounds. It has simply amplified them.
We followed the aggrieved and infuriated Trump supporters as they stormed the building.
I swear to CNN, and they just sent these guys.
Through broken windows and doors they had forced open. And for a few heady moments, they felt they had won a precious victory.
USA! 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 Stop the steal! 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 Stop the steal!
They were now in the very heart of the congressional building.
Of storming Congress itself.
Because they work for us. They don't get to steal it from us. They don't get to tell us we didn't see what we saw.
We respect the law. We were good people. The government did this to us. We were normal, good, law-abiding citizens, and you guys did this to us. We want our country back. We are protesting for our freedom right now. That's the difference.
What's the purpose of storming Congress?
How do I know that?
They reached and entered the Speaker's office itself. Although Nancy Pelosi and other lawmakers had already been evacuated to safety.
There you go, brother.
As we filmed, protesters tore down Pelosi's nameplate.
And so here we are right now inside the halls of Congress. This is exactly what so many anticipated, and yet the Capitol Hill police are doing their best, but failing to control the situation.
That was Robert Moore giving you meaning to reporting from the front line there for ITN. We thank ITN for that footage. Now, in Washington, D.C., a new day has just started, so let's go there straight away to our Washington editor, Amber Athey. Amber, what's it like the morning after the night before?
It's a very bizarre feeling here in D.C. It seemed like everyone feels very somber about what happened. I actually attended the march yesterday to cover it for The Spectator, but my group ended up leaving around 12:30 in the middle of Trump's speech, so well before any of this mob rioting started to occur, well before people started marching on the Capitol. And at that time, everything was incredibly peaceful. I mean, even when Rudy Giuliani made this comment about trial by combat, first of all, it was incredibly hard to hear the speakers. And second, I didn't see people react to that. No one seemed to be getting riled up by comments like that. Everyone, to me, seemed like they were just happy to be around fellow like-minded Trump supporters. And that was very much the vibe as we got on the metro and headed home. People were just tired from the day and felt like they had a good time. They were glad that they had come across country for this. We ended up meeting up with several other people at a bar later. And there were Trump supporters filing in throughout the day who legitimately had no idea what was even going on at the Capitol and were stunned when they saw the scenes unfold on cable television. And perhaps one of the craziest or most stunning moments for me was watching several bartenders at this restaurant crying as they watched what was happening in their nation's capital. So I think everyone is very concerned about what happens next, very concerned about the fact that the Capitol building was able to be breached so easily with seemingly very little police presence. And again, just a very weird mood here.
Well, it's not unusual for peaceful protests to end in violence. That happens with left-wing and right-wing demonstrations. But in this case, Amber, what went wrong? What turned the peaceful protest you saw, peaceful demonstration, into these scenes of violence and basically assaulting Capitol Hill?
Yeah, it seems to me like what happened here is a culmination of really a sad state of affairs in American society. And this could have happened with any group, in my opinion, because over the summer, we had months of riots, a literal occupation in Portland for over 100 days, an autonomous zone in Seattle where people were shot and killed. And all of that violence was actually cheered on by a lot of our political elites, cheered on by the media. And that type of violence has been seen to be rewarded in American society over the past couple of years. And so these people who have been stuck in lockdown for 8 months, very much in social isolation, very little aid given to them by the government, now they're of the belief that in a Democratic election was stolen from them. They go down to the Capitol building, and it's like a powder keg just waiting to be ignited from people who have felt disenfranchised for so long. They have this opportunity in front of them where they can finally get the political elite to listen to them. There are maybe five police officers holding them back from it. And that's exactly what you saw what happened, is people were at the gates of the, you know, the political establishment and said, this is it, this is our time.
Why were the law enforcement authorities so unprepared?
That's a question that everyone is confused by. You know, when I first went into the march, there were streets blocked off 6, 7, if not 10 blocks away from this protest, which was much smaller than the Million MAGA March that took place shortly after the election. And there were police by the barricades on these streets. And so it seemed very bizarre to me that there were fewer police at the Capitol, it seemed, than were in the surrounding streets in front of businesses and other non-governmental buildings. It was a very odd thing to see. I don't really understand why they weren't prepared for this. And, you know, DC has a very short memory. This happened in 2018, where, granted, there weren't people clashing with police officers, but during the Kavanaugh hearings, the Women's March orchestrated a march on the Capitol. At that time, the police were well prepared. They had barricaded the area very well. There were numerous police officers. So instead, what the Women's March did is they entered the Hart Senate building. There were thousands of people in the atrium of the Hart Senate building during the Kavanaugh hearings, to the point where they actually had to delay them. And 300 arrests were made on that day. So this is not entirely unprecedented. And you have to question why exactly the police were not prepared for something like this to happen when there are 20,000 people on the National Mall.
Freddie Gray, our U.S. editor, will President Trump's years in the White House now not be forever tainted by the scenes we saw last night?
I think they probably will be now. And I keep thinking to myself, or keep trying to do a sort of thought experiment with myself. Let's imagine that in the days after the election, not necessarily on the night because it was very confused, that Trump had accepted the result and said, you know, it's a tough one to take, but I congratulate my opponent, Joe Biden. And then he probably could have tweeted, you know, nastily about it afterwards. But everyone would have been impressed that he'd behaved with some dignity. And he would have positioned himself, having just won 70 million votes, he would have positioned himself as a one-term president, so a failure in some ways, but somebody who could well come back in 2024 and win if he wanted to, and could perhaps even have had a sort of graceful retirement. But he took the other road, and at the moment it looks like it was a disastrous road to have taken for him and for the country.
Kit Andrews, our economics correspondent, resident American in the UK. Has this not seriously undermined any hopes Mr. Trump might have harbored of coming back in 2024?
I think it has, Andrew, because it is going to be impossible to shake off the reputation now as somebody who quite directly was trying to undermine America's democratic processes. And regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, it is a founding principle in American society. It's a core value for voters that we are transparent and fair and that we respect results. And the problem for the president is that he has taken every pathway possible to try to overturn it. He went to the states, he went higher, he went to the Supreme Court, and everybody has thrown out his complaints. He had a right to take them, but they have not been upheld. And I think it is impossible, it absolutely impossible, to separate the president from the scenes that we saw last night. He has been stoking division and doubt amongst his supporters for months now, telling them that the election result wasn't fair. And there are reports that Senator Mitt Romney, once the senators were put into a safe space, was yelling at senators like Ted Cruz, who have been embracing the president's remarks, saying, "This is what you've gotten." Essentially, this is what happens when you lie to people about the result of the election. And, you know, that starts and stops really with Donald Trump. That's not to say other Republicans aren't responsible. Frankly, I think they are. But if we're going to place blame, it is with the president. And Donald Trump likes the conversation to be about him, certainly when it's good news. But if it's bad news and he makes a mistake, well, you know, that has to sit with him and his legacy too.
Amber, is it not also bad news for those Republicans like Senator Ted Cruz, who have been giving air to Trump's allegations of election fraud? They seem to have been backing him. This is surely going to be a huge embarrassment for them, too.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult for senators like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, who I actually think took a fairly reasonable position in the way that they responded to the president's allegations. For example, Josh Hawley was basically only challenging the results in a couple of states and calling for an investigation into alleged fraud or last-minute changing of the rules, but wasn't outright stating that the election was a fraud and that it needed to be overturned. But now, because of the scenes at the Capitol, because of the way that this all shook out, it's practically impossible, very, very difficult for these people to stake that claim now. And that's why you saw many senators yesterday reversing their decisions to challenge the results, because they didn't want to be associated with any sense of violence.
Freddie, how does the Republican Party move on from Donald Trump if he allows them to move on? Will there be a sense, will a lot of Republicans start to realize that rather than being an asset, he's actually a loser? He lost the White House by 7 million votes, huge number. He lost the House. He's now lost the Senate as well. And he's lost America's Democratic reputation after last night.
Well, there is all that, but then there's also the fact that he does have huge support among the base. It's a problem for the Republican Party if they want to disassociate themselves from Trump's legacy. And I think what you've had in the Republican Party the last 4 years, Daniel McCarthy, one of our writers, called it a cyborg. And it's a sort of combination of an uncomfortable Republican Party and the Trump movement. And it just about sort of struggled through the Trump years. But it was never a comfortable alliance, and it never sat well together. And we saw in the Senate runoff races in Georgia, it doesn't win. Kelly Loeffler's an almost perfect example of a Trump-Republican cyborg. It's insincere. It puts off working-class voters in the end, and it loses elections.
But let me come back to you, because I don't really see the way forward with the Republican Party at the moment, because it's like Trump is like this huge shadow overhanging them. I can see where in a number of policy areas, Mr. Trump leaves a legacy, concentration on jobs for blue-collar workers, a tougher line with China, a new way of getting peace in the Middle East. I can see all that, and the Republicans will want to bank that and make that part of their future appeal. But how do they do that and somehow manage to ditch Mr. Trump?
Yeah, that's the most difficult question moving forward, because, you know, I've always said that I thought Trumpism was able to be separated from the person Trump. That obviously becomes a lot more difficult with the way that he's handled this election and, of course, the scenes that happened at the Capitol yesterday. Trump can either choose to fade away after this, not wanting to be scarred forever by the scenes that we saw yesterday, or he's going to try to stay around and continue to be a Republican kingmaker. I think the latter option shows a bit of cowardice, because it's ultimately his supporters who he hung out to dry. He told these people to walk to the Capitol and that he was going to be with them while he went back into the White House and hid in safety. So for him to encourage these people repeatedly, telling them that Mike Pence could ultimately save the Republic, and encouraging this type of aggression towards politicians, he has to take the blame for that, and he has to consider if he even cares about the Republican Party, which I think maybe he probably doesn't. Then he has to consider moving forward how he's going to make it possible for the Republican Party to continue to embrace his principles moving forward. And right now it seems the best option is for him to sort of fade from memory.
But he likes Kate the limelight, and he may not just fade. That may be best for the Republican Party as they try to rebuild. But he may not go away quietly. He could hang around and really be the cuckoo in the nest, could he not?
He could if he wanted to. It'll be interesting to see what extent the media still gives him attention. If anything, I'd say it's already gone quieter up until really the past few days in relation to Trump and his opinions as people pivot to President-elect Joe Biden. But again, this is a decision for the Republican Party, because in America, we don't have party leaders in the same way. If a party isn't in power, and for everything Donald Trump has done, it has essentially led to nothing for the coming years because the Democrats have taken back control of the Oval Office and of Congress. The Republicans now have the opportunity, with no real leader technically in charge, to start soul-searching, debating amongst each other, figuring out what went wrong, figuring out why a Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan was so willing at the smallest sniff of power to hand over everything to Donald Trump, to never challenge him when he put his foot over the line. If they allow him to continue to cloud that debate and to dominate that debate, they're going to be in a more difficult position in 2024. And I agree with you, Andrew. You know, this is the moment to separate policies from the man, to figure out what was actually good for the American people and what Donald Trump thought was good for him. If they can keep the former and remove the latter, they've got a real shot even to take back the Senate in a few years' time. But if Donald Trump continues to dominate, I fear for the Republican Party's future, not just in the next few years, but possibly over decades, they could do real irreversible damage.
But meanwhile, Freddie, the Democrats control the executive branch and both houses in the legislature. And I would suggest that that is, particularly the Senate, that is down to Donald Trump. He lost Georgia. It was winnable for the Republicans. The further you go down the ticket, the more Republican Georgia still is. But that telephone call to the Secretary of State of Georgia, I mean, it was like a banana republic dictator leaning on one of his lieutenants to find 11,750 votes. It was a most remarkable conversation. And if you tell your own supporters that it's a fraudulent election, that the elections can't be trusted, you shouldn't be surprised if they don't turn out and bother to vote.
Well, Andrew, yes, that was a ridiculous conversation. A lot of people said that the Washington Post had edited it to make it sound a lot worse than it was. But if you listen to the whole thing, it is actually pretty bad. It's pretty awful. And Trump sounds desperate and sort of strangely hopeless. But I would say the opportunity for the Republican Party in the next few years is going to be the fact that the Democrats now control the executive, or will soon control the executive and the legislature. This means that they will have almost total power, unbridled power in Congress. And it means that the excuse that the Democrats have had, that Barack Obama used a lot, that Joe Biden also uses a lot, that they would transform America in the progressive direction that a lot of their base want them to go, were it not for the Republicans, is gone. And so they will now have to accommodate their progressive base. And this will mean they are way to the left of the American mainstream on a lot of issues. And it will be interesting to see how the electorate react to that in 2022 and moving ahead to 2024. If the Republican Party can come up with a coherent response to that, then they could win again quite soon.
It's always dangerous, though, Amber, when the opposition party depends on government to completely screw up in order to get back into power. I mean, there was an opportunity here with the Democrats, with a moderate president in the White House, a smallish Democrat majority in the House. It had come down a bit after the November election, and a smallish Republican majority in the Senate. That kind of combination could have led to quite centrist, moderate government overall in the United States. But thanks to Mr. Trump's cavalier approach to Georgia, it's lock, stock, and barrel to the Democrats now. They're in charge.
Sure. And I wouldn't say that Trump is solely to blame for Georgia. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. Mitch McConnell certainly bears some blame there as well for refusing to pass the $2,000 stimulus check. When you look at polls in Georgia, that was a very popular issue with voters. I think it was something like 75% of voters agreed with having $2,000 stimulus checks. So if you already have this situation where maybe Republican turnout is being suppressed a bit because people feel that their vote's not going to be counted, as well as perhaps independents who feel like their only shot at getting a stimulus check after 8 months of a pandemic is by putting Democrats in power, then that really is a recipe for disaster.
Let's just look ahead. The news cycle these days moves very quickly. It could be that Mr. Trump will be but a memory by the spring equinox. Who knows? But we will have a Biden administration, and with a majority in the House and a casting vote of the vice president in the Senate. But let's look ahead to the next couple of months. Tell me, I'll start with you, Kate. How do you see the Biden administration playing out in its first 4 to 6 months? With the Senate now, it'll probably get a bigger stimulus bill through the Congress than it would have done if the Republicans had held on to the Senate.
I think we're going to see a lot more spending on the COVID crisis, Andrew, with less accountability. You're not going to have the Senate in the GOP's hands to at least ask questions about how much money is being spent. Not that they've been particularly fiscally responsible even in the last 4 years, but you're going to have less debate around that issue. I do suspect, though, from Joe Biden's comments, certainly in the past 20 hours, over the past few months, that this is not going to be a president who's out for blood, who's going to want to point many fingers, especially at the voters that he knows he could potentially win back on side, who might be a bit skeptical of him, but are just looking for a calmer and slightly more relaxed environment in American politics. He very much pointed the blame for last night's chaos at the president and at the mob itself. I don't think he's going to be pointing it so much at the Republican Party, and certainly not at its voters. I'm hopeful that in the next few months, we might find a Republican Party that is a bit more introspective, willing to work with Joe Biden to be more moderate, to be more centrist, to put off those in Joe Biden's party who would like to see him tack to the left. I mean, after everything that's happened in the past 20 hours, I can't say I'm too hopeful, but I think there is still a chance at some unity in coming together to further help America recover from this COVID crisis, and the real debate might start in a year or so when both parties are thinking about the next election.
I guess, Amber, in one regard, Mr. Biden will be pleased. He now controls both houses and the White House. On the other hand, he's lost any excuses for the left of the Democrats to say, look, I agree with you, I'd like to do that, but I couldn't get it through a Republican Senate. He can't play that card anymore.
Yeah, as often happens in situations like this where parties do control all parts of the government, there tends to be a lot more infighting over exactly how they're going to use that power. The same exact thing happened during the beginning of the Trump administration when Republicans held the House and the Senate, and the only thing they were somehow able to get done was this tax cut that was only temporary for the middle class and permanent for corporations. So I wouldn't expect that the Biden administration will be that much more successful holding all of this power. And that's where the Republican Party has this opportunity going into 2022. If they're able to navigate this sort of landmine now where they have to embrace some tenets of Trumpism like nationalism and populism that have been very appealing to the working and middle class, but somehow separate themselves from the fact that he went out on such a sour note, they could stand to do very well in 2 years.
Freddie, finally to you, what's the first major pitfall that faces the Biden administration?
Well, I mean, I think that the pandemic is obviously the big problem they're going to grapple with, and they seem to be very, very lockdown-minded. I don't know how well that will go down with middle America. And I think the key figure really is going to be Kamala Harris, who now, with a 50-50 split Senate, is going to be deciding the most controversial issues in America, the most controversial legislation in America. I'm not actually sure that's a position she might want, considering we think she has her eyes on the White House, possibly as soon as 2023.
She'll have to spend a lot of time in that Senate seat.
Yeah.
But given that it's all going to be on a knife edge, all the votes, she'll have to be there to be the casting vote, which may inhibit, as you say, her other activities. Let's leave it there for the moment after these horrible and historic scenes in Capitol Hill last night. 13 days to the inauguration. Now let's hope there is no more violence in the run-up to that and the inauguration itself goes off the way inaugurations are meant to go off. After all, the hallmark of democracy is the peaceful transfer of power. That's what makes it different from every other form of government. Ready, Kate, Amber? Thanks for joining me today. Remember, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free, you'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. Now, back home in dear old Blighty, the COVID situation is worsening and quickly. There's a lot to unpack since our last show towards the end of 2020. The Oxford vaccine rollout has started, but the government is in a race against time. Infections in the UK are almost as bad as they were in March last year. Schools are closed again. All four nations of the United Kingdom are giving stay-at-home orders. There are two new strains, both of which seem vastly more infectious, if not necessarily more toxic, than what we've been used to. Fraser Nelson, the Spectator editor, is on hand to give us the latest overview on graphs from our new daily updated data hub, which is a must read for those who want to keep up with what's happening on COVID. Fraser, over to you.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, since the start of the pandemic, we at The Spectator have been keeping track of all the relevant data, not just the infectious and deaths, but other things that decide policy, like how busy are the intensive care units, how full are the hospitals. And we thought that rather than, normally you see these graphs when a journalist wants to show you them, plonked in the middle of an analysis, normally backing up the journalist's point. We thought we'd make this available for everybody so you can have a look at your own figures. People can see and perhaps spot trends which journalists might be missing. And I'll give you an example. Quite often we're used to seeing every day there were so many new infections yesterday, there were 20,000, 40,000. But those figures are hugely affected by the number of tests taken. Now, of course, recently we've seen a trebling, sometimes a quadrupling, in the numbers of tests taken every day, which has led some people to say, well, maybe the increase in COVID cases isn't as high as the figures say. So let's look at our first graph, for example. The Office for National Statistics will tell you how many infections there are in Britain at any one time. And it does this by doing a sample. Now, this sample shows that while back in September, there was very little COVID in Britain, at the last count, there were 1.2 million people estimated to have COVID at any one time. Now, that is something like 1 in 50 of the population. When you've got COVID of that levels, you're sure that hospitalizations and deaths will surely follow. Now, that is a pretty grim chart, one that's only moving upwards. And it raises an interesting question. Why, if the situation is so bleak, are ministers so relatively optimistic? When James Forsyth and I went to see Matt Hancock a couple of days ago to interview him for this week's magazine, and we left just struck by how upbeat he is, how convinced he is that we're just a few weeks away from this. He was using phrases like cry freedom for the end of restrictions. So what makes him so optimistic? Sure, they're vaccinating, but we've only managed to do 1.5 million vaccines so far, more than anybody else in Europe, but certainly a far cry away from the 40 million adults there are in this country. But have a look at the priority list. Those who are in care homes, they're getting vaccinated first, they make up about 1 million people. Then it's the over 80s, they're second in line. Then those aged 75 and over, 70 and over, and then the rest. So the thing about COVID is that a large number of fatalities come from a relatively small number of people. So these are the figures I'm about to show you that are giving government ministers their optimism. In care homes, for example, if you cover just 1 million people, then you've covered the group responsible for 36% of the deaths. So you should, in theory, have covered a third of those most likely to die from COVID in coming months. If you take that to the over 80s, and then it's 66%, so that's two-thirds of those likely to die from COVID. And already, about a quarter of the over 80s have been vaccinated in Britain. So when you go down to the over 65s, you're then looking at about 93%. So this is why the Prime Minister is talking about Easter. He reckons that by the middle of March, you'll have covered pretty much 4 out of 5 people likely to die from COVID, thereby downgrading the virus from something which fills up hospitals and causes excess deaths into something which is more of a headache that will put you in bed for a few days, but will not pose a challenge or as big a challenge to the health service. Now, that is, of course, quite a big gamble. After all, a third of those in hospital are under 65. But the other thing is that you're looking at a system now where the rates of hospitalisation are increasing so fast that in London, this time last month, people in hospital with COVID, it was barely a third of the peak. But look at it now, far over that peak. We're hearing reports now that even now it looks like London hospitals are in grave danger of being overwhelmed. So we're looking at a bit of a race against time. That's the theme of the cover for the magazine this week, the vaccine versus the virus. And with that, Andrew, back to you.
Thanks, Fraser. So just to clarify, the government believes that the quickest way to cut the death rate, to cut the number of deaths, is to concentrate on the most vulnerable, because that will have the biggest impact. The more you vaccinate them, the more the death rate will come down from COVID.
That's right. And they further believe that you can cover, 3/4, 4/5 of those likely to die within a few weeks. Of course, it's not quite as fast as that, because the vaccine takes between 2 and 3 weeks to have any effect, and then there's a further 3 and 4 weeks to go delay between infections and the death figures. So it might be quite some time before we see any effect of this in the daily death toll from COVID. But why they're optimistic is they think that it will only take a few million vaccines, as long as they can correctly target those at risk, to make a really quite considerable difference in the British death toll and just transform the debate about COVID and stop it being seen as much as a disease which puts people in hospital and takes lives.
But I think you just said something that's quite important and not everybody realises. If you get vaccinated tomorrow, it's at least 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks before you are largely immune to the virus. Is that right?
That's right. And that's, of course, after the first jab. Pfizer recommends people take 2 jabs to get up to 95%. But the government thinks you can get about 70% protection from the first jab, but it takes a while for that to happen. My 90-year-old neighbour, for example, told me today she was going to get her jab on Friday and was offering kindly to babysit on Friday evening. I had to say to her, no, it's going to be a few weeks before it's safe for you to go everywhere. So I do wonder if people are wrongly thinking that once they get the jab, they're protected. They should be staying at home and shielding for 2, I would say 3 weeks before it's really safe to regard yourself as protected. And even then, after the first jab, you're not 100% protected. There is still plenty of reason for caution.
Well, that's an important point for anybody watching, that if they do get vaccinated, particularly the older people, you've still got to shield for at least a couple of weeks, up to 3, to make sure that you are largely immune. And then you haven't got the full immunity, or as much as you can have, until you get the second jab. It's a great interview with the Health Secretary, Fraser. I take it his general upbeat approach is entirely down to the prospects of the vaccine. Is that right?
That's right. They're quite optimistic. They've got the army embedded, literally embedded in the NHS. On the top floor of the NHS head office, there are something like 60 uniformed officers under the commander of Brigadier Phil Prosser, who's a commander of 101 Logistics Division. So they think that they're really optimistic at being able to deliver vaccines as fast as the manufacturers can churn them out. Now, that's quite a big if, because it's not simply a matter of making the vaccines. The Oxford one has to lie for something like 20 days, a sterilisation period, then batches need to get approved by the regulator. So logistically, there's a lot which could go wrong. Also, in our cover piece of the magazine this week, Richard Dobbs points out that you would need a pretty good take-up rate. What happens if 20% of those invited for a vaccine don't actually show up? What happens if the NHS don't have the addresses or the records? You could still end up with quite a lot of people who should be protected not being protected. And that would mean that the virus hospitalisation and death figures don't go down as fast as the ministers are hoping for right now.
No, there are clearly lots of problems to get this right. But I would have to say that if you're looking from France or Germany or Italy or Spain, they're the kind of problems you'd like to have.
Yeah, right now it's funny that Britain has vaccinated more people than the rest of Europe put together, partly because we started on December the 8th. And Matt Hancock, when James and I interviewed him, was basically thinking that what has happened, that we've got a regulator moving at very fast speed. He thinks this will be the future for Britain's future as a biotech hub. He thinks companies are going to locate in Britain for a favourable experience with a regulator that has been able to move far quicker than its counterparts in Europe.
Well, so far with the vaccine, despite the problems, it's pretty much good news to date, with lots of challenges ahead. So given it's good news, you probably won't see much of that in a lot of the media. Fraser, thanks for that. Thanks for all that work on the Data Hub with you and your team. It's a real go-to place if you want to get the latest stats. It's on our website and it's regularly updated. Let's turn to the politics of this, joined by James Forsyth, our political editor, Katie Bowles, our deputy political editor. James, am I right in thinking that because of this huge leap in cases in this second wave or third wave, whatever it is, plus a substantial rise in deaths, that the Tory lockdown skeptics are a little less rebellious or inclined to kick out at the moment?
Yes, I mean, the rise in cases combined with the vaccine means that this third lockdown is far less controversial on the Tory benches than the second one was. I think you look at the current rate of infections, which is still obviously going to lead to hospitalizations and deaths, and it's very hard to argue against a lockdown unless you are, you know, a diehard libertarian. In the same way that there are very few atheists in a foxhole, there are very few diehard libertarians when, you know, one in 50 of the population have a virus, have this virus during a pandemic. And I think the argument on the Tory benches is all shifting to this question of when do the restrictions go? I think that you saw Mark Harper, who we've had on Spectator TV, who's the kind of chair of a COVID recovery group, you know, pushing Matt Hancock to say essentially, once you've vaccinated this 13 odd million people who are most vulnerable to dying from COVID, shouldn't all the restrictions go then? I don't think they all will go then, but I think when you hit that 28 million people, which is the whole first phase of the vaccine, when Jonathan Van Tam talked about, who account for over 90% of both deaths and hospitalizations, I think that's when you see the restrictions go. And if you do a bit of crude maths, if you say that we're doing 2 million vaccinations a week by the middle of February, which the government will have to be doing to hit its target, that suggests that by the beginning of April, you should have managed to vaccinate those 28 million people, or given them their first shot, to be accurate.
Right, yeah, the first one, exactly. Katie, as a consequence, the Tory backbenchers are not quite in the same rebellious mood against lockdown and restrictions as they were in the run-up to Christmas?
Yes, and we saw a very small rebellion if you look at the retrospective Commons vote we had on the third lockdown yesterday. Just around 14 rebels, and not all of those were Tories. You had DUP in there. So I think there is a sense that it's almost stopped being a live issue on lockdown. As James touched on, the debate has moved. And I think what's been really striking is, for example, Boris Johnson had a Zoom video call with his MPs on the day before this was to be voted on in the Commons. And it had all the ingredients to be a bit of a horror show for the Prime Minister. When you had the second national lockdown, something Boris Johnson has ultimately said that he didn't plan on doing, there was a really furious response from Tory MPs. And at the time, that was a rebellion over 50. His backbench said, if you do this a third time, you're going to be facing a three-figure rebellion. Now, it's nowhere near that. And actually, in the Q&A session, there were no questions from Tory MPs saying, I disagree with the seven-week lockdown. Instead, what's happened is the conversation has moved to mitigating some of the effects, to looking at the vaccine rollout. And I don't think this is just because of the vaccine, because when we had the vaccine approved a while back, you still had people like Mark Harper, chair of the COVID recovery group, talking about ultimately the fact that they wanted to have more of an exit strategy. I think it is, to be frank, down to the really quite terrifying data that means no one wants to take a risk, or at least a very small number do. As one Tory MP described, you now have the very hard radicals, they think are the people who are opposing lockdown. The mainstream debate in the party is now how many vaccinated before you can get rid of restrictions.
James, would it be too dramatic to say that the Prime Minister's future now depends on the successful rollout of this vaccine? I'm looking at the figures in France. After week one, only about 500 people had been vaccinated. That's 500, not 500,000 or 50,000, 500. And even now, despite Mr. Macron's intervention, it's barely around 7,000. If the British effort, now it's already well over 1.3, so it's not going there, but if it somehow it was to stumble badly, not to deliver anywhere near the 13 million by the end of February that has been promised, that would be incredibly politically damaging, wouldn't it?
Yes, and I think for the reasons Katie said, I think you'd see the Tory benches explode with rage if you were in a situation where the restrictions had to stay in place for months and months into the second half of this year because the vaccine wasn't being rolled out quick enough. I think that this vaccine rollout is crucial to how voters view the government's entire handling of this pandemic and this country's international reputation. If you are in a situation where this country in April, May is beginning to ease restrictions while Europe is having to keep them in place because this country has managed to vaccinate more people, then I think that could transform voters' views on how the government has handled the pandemic and this view of Britain in the world. I think it would be an advert for it would make Brexit Britain look like a more successful country than it currently does today. Now, I think we've got people are understandably fed up with all the talk of world-beating things from the government that haven't turned out to be world-beating, such as Test and Trace. But the UK has two huge advantages in this vaccine race. The first is the UK has a regulator-approved, domestically produced vaccine that is logistically easy to distribute. It only needs to be kept at fridge temperature, which makes it far simpler than Pfizer and Moderna in terms of distribution. The second thing is the UK has a public that is very willing to take the vaccine. According to some polling, there is no population in the world that is more willing to take the vaccine. So you don't have, I think one of the things that is constraining the vaccine rollout in France, you were talking about, is the level of anti-vax sentiment there, which has slowed things down. You don't have that issue here. And interestingly, the government's, the Department of Health's internal polling shows that there's been a over 10-point increase in the number of people keen to take the vaccine since October. So the British public is getting keener and keener on taking this vaccine. And I think that means that the take-up rates, which Fraser was talking about, should be high, which would mean that you should be able to, that gives you a chance to ease up the restrictions faster. So this really does all turn now on whether the British state is capable of rolling this vaccine out at pace.
James, you went with Fraser to see the Secretary of State for Health. What did you make of his general demeanour?
I think, as Fraser says, the striking thing about Matt Hancock is how optimistic he is, how close he thinks we are to the finish line. And you've got Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, saying that she's more worried now than she has been at any point since March. You've obviously got a 1 in 50 rate of infection according to the ONS. But Matt Hancock is convinced that this vaccine offers a route out. And I think the other thing I was very struck by was how he was very clear about two things. First of all, he thinks that people are essentially protected from 2 to 3 weeks after that first shot. So there is a big move from this two-shot vaccine to the first shot is what they consider to be crucial now. And then the second thing is he was very clear that the restrictions go when the vulnerable have been vaccinated. This is not a question of the restrictions go when you've achieved herd immunity through vaccination, which would require kind of 70-80% of the population to have been vaccinated. Rather, he thinks the restrictions will go as soon as you've broken that link between infections, hospitalizations, and deaths.
It's interesting that the Scottish government doesn't refer to the Oxford vaccine. It refers to the AstraZeneca vaccine. I wonder why. I'll just leave that to ponder in the air. Just as Nicola Sturgeon couldn't bring herself when she did thank the armed forces, they were called our armed forces, not the British armed forces for some reason. That was also dropped. Fraser, back to you for a final point before we go to the former Secretary of State for Health. It is interesting how the political cycle gets increasingly truncated. The papers, the media full of Boris Johnson's U-turn before Christmas, having said it would be inhuman to cancel Christmas, he then cancelled it. You draw over that, then telling the BBC last Sunday that the schools were perfectly safe, and then in 24 hours, closing schools. And yet it already all seems to be kind of ancient history, as we have all eyes on the vaccine.
I think it does matter because it has a kind of corrosive effect on trust. These broken promises pile up, and when people hear Boris Johnson saying we're going to be out of this by Easter, their first reaction is, well, we're certainly not going to be out of this by Easter because he's been proven wrong so often. Now, this matters, I think, not necessarily at times of national crisis when COVID hospital figures are going up so much as they are right now, but it matters longer term. I mean, take Nicola Sturgeon, who you mentioned earlier. She hasn't made broken promises. She's been pretty straight with Scots. Her performance hasn't been great on COVID, but what she hasn't done is give a long list of promises which she wouldn't meet. She has under-promised, whereas Boris Johnson has over-promised. His optimism has been his own greatest enemy. Funny that before this came along, support for independence wasn't particularly high in Scotland. It hadn't really changed since Brexit. It was only during the pandemic that people started to contrast Nicola Sturgeon's record in broken promises with that of Boris Johnson, and they concluded that she was the more dependable leader. So the pandemic has put the union on the brink. And if Boris Johnson ever does manage to get out of the COVID tunnel, as he calls it, he'll find Nicola Sturgeon waiting for him with the May elections in Scotland, where she's likely to get a majority and use that majority to call for another independence referendum.
Indeed. Let's leave it there. James, Katie, Fraser, thank you for that. I'm delighted to say we're joined now by Jeremy Hunt. He's the longest serving health secretary in England. He's now chairs the select committee and is a conservative backbencher. Jeremy, welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
Let me ask you this. Clearly, the rollout of the vaccine is both a vital medical imperative in dealing with COVID, and it's very important, as we've been saying, politically for Mr. Johnson and his government. What will be the challenges? What are the biggest challenges you think the government faces in getting this rollout to 13 million of the most vulnerable before February is out?
Well, it is a massive logistical exercise, but we have one big advantage over the problems that we had with track and trace and the contact tracing and the centralized testing laboratories last year, which is that we're not using new infrastructure to do this. We're using our existing network of GPs, supplemented by new centers that are being set up, but a lot of it will be the existing infrastructure. And I'm actually quite optimistic that the NHS will rise to the challenge. I think that the numbers that have been done so far are actually very impressive, to have got to more than a million already. And I think the challenge we've got is actually not on the vaccine rollout. It is the question of whether the NHS is going to fall over, because the Health Service Journal is saying that within 2 weeks, London will run out of intensive care capacity. But we know from previous lockdowns with this virus, there's a 3 week delay between doing something big like a lockdown and it actually feeding through into hospital admissions. And that is too long when it comes to London. So I think it's going to be a very, very nail biting next few weeks.
Is it too late to do anything about that hospital capacity now? Is it inevitable that in the next couple of weeks we'll get to where you described, or is there emergency action that can be taken?
There is, and I don't actually think we will get to the point where someone who needs an intensive care bed doesn't get one, because the NHS at the moment will be scrabbling around frantically to try and source those extra beds, whether from the private sector, whether from neighbouring trusts, and I think they'll do it. But what I don't think will happen is that I don't think we'll be able to avoid the knock-on effects on things like cancer care. Maybe some people who might have been sent to intensive care, a borderline case in previous times, won't get sent this time. Who knows? You know, the outcome might not be as good for that person. So I'm afraid the kind of knock-on effects that we saw in the first lockdown in terms of the impact on other NHS care will be very severe.
The government has been widely criticised over the months for its handling of the whole COVID crisis. Every government's been criticised, but Mr. Johnson's government has come in for more than most. Is the vaccine its get out of jail card? Does the vaccine overwhelm all the other criticisms?
I think it could. I rather agree with James's analysis just now. We were too slow to go into lockdown, too slow to adopt test and trace as a methodology, but we have been the best in the world at approving vaccines, and in terms of distributing them, just behind Israel, so better than any other comparably sized country. And I think we can say with a lot of pride, it wasn't just the brilliance of British science, and of course the Pfizer vaccine wasn't developed in this country, but obviously the Oxford AstraZeneca, well, I'm going to put the word Oxford in, even if Nicola Sturgeon won't. It was, and I think that may turn out to be the best vaccine as it happens. But actually government decisions. I mean, Matt Hancock set up the vaccine task force with Kate Bingham, you know, that had controversy in the early days. He made a big play gambling on pre-buying quantities, huge quantities of different types of vaccines. And those gambles paid off. And that was a ministerial decision, and he should get a lot of credit for that. So I think if this works out, people will say, well, we had a very tough pandemic. We didn't get it all right, but we got some things very right. And if we're the first country to get back to normal, that will be a very, very big fillip for the government.
I think most people regard this as a national effort, almost like a wartime effort to roll out this vaccine, and that it has to be all hands to the deck. That's understandable. So what do you make then of when we hear that Public Health England says it won't work on Sundays?
I do think that's extraordinary. I'm a little bit hesitant to sort of pile in until I actually know that's true. But if it is true, and if I had been a minister, I would have been sending that recommendation right back and saying, what on earth are you talking about? This is absolute nonsense.
And has the government, I mean, it has seemed that time and again, the government has been behind the curve. I think it's a criticism you have made of them too, particularly when it comes to lockdown. Is that because of Mr. Johnson's kind of natural libertarian instincts, that he's always been reluctant to do what he's ended up having to do, as we've seen this week?
I think it may be that. And in some ways, I think that because of those instincts, when we do finally do a lockdown, there's quite a lot of public support for it, because people do recognize this is not something the government has rushed into. And I think there are genuine issues. I think we should have gone in earlier. And actually, even this week, I think we should have made the decision last week, because I'm not really sure what data was only available on Monday that we couldn't have seen on Thursday or Friday of last week. But nonetheless, on Monday, he had a meeting on Monday afternoon. He made the decision. We went bang into lockdown from the following morning. That is a whole lot quicker than the speed that decisions were made at the start of the pandemic.
Were we equipped to deal with this? I mean, clearly not when you look at what's happened. But you were Secretary of State for Health when this Operation Cygnus, the pandemic war game, was carried out. And it was a very extensive war game, and I read quite a lot about it. But it wasn't for a COVID-type pandemic. It was the wrong war game, wasn't it?
That's exactly the point. I mean, all the recommendations that were made to ministers following that pandemic were implemented. And there were some that were very useful for this pandemic. For example, drafting the emergency powers legislation, that was a pretty important piece of work that came out, which we sadly did have to put into practice. But if you look through that report, there is not a mention anywhere of testing, not once. And that kind of sums up that we were, not just in this country, but across the whole of Europe and America, there was this groupthink that pandemic equals flu pandemic. And, you know, looking back on it, you have to say, you know, we had SARS in 2002, MERS in 2014. They happen to be in other parts of the world. But I think it's very important that we set up structures now to make sure that that groupthink, of which I was part, doesn't take hold going forward.
Well, let's go forward a little bit finally, Jeremy Hunt. From what you've been saying, it seems possible that if we get the 13 million rollout to the most vulnerable groups by the end of February, we will after that begin to see the death rate and the case numbers begin to fall. We can then get more, a lot more than 13 million. And it may not be pie in the sky to think that sometime after Easter, which is very early this year in April, that there could be not an event that's a return to normality, but the beginnings of a process that heads towards some semblance of normality.
Well, I'm an optimist, and I've booked a family holiday for the summer half term, which is the first week of June. So I very much hope that I don't have to get another of these bloody vouchers that the airlines give you when you cancel your tickets. But I do think there is a lot of risk, and I think we've just got to recognise the most important thing is something we're going to hear in the next 2 weeks, which are the results of the test, which they're doing, Public Health England are doing at Portendown at the moment, which say whether the vaccine works against the new Kent strain. And then about a week after that, we should hear whether the vaccine works against the South African strain. And that is the bit of information that I am really waiting for before I start banking everything on Easter.
Good thing. We'll look out for that. And we all hope you get your holiday at the beginning of June as well. Jeremy Hunt, thank you for joining us here on Spectator TV. That's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests, and once again to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley, who's continuing to sponsor The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to have them as our partners. A final reminder that if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, and it doesn't cost a penny, you'll never miss another episode. You just click the subscribe button at the bottom of the screen right now. And as always, please send any thoughts to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. Join us again next week. Bye-bye.